Welcome to Morgan Lewis Podcast Central. This is a podcast recording from Morgan Lewis's June 9th, 2016, 9th Annual Advanced Topics in Hedge Fund Practices Conference. Morgan Lewis partners Jed Wider and Timothy Levin shared this 14-part in-depth discussion of U.S. and international advanced hedge fund topics focusing on manager and investor perspectives. Part 2, Regulatory and Examination Priorities for Private Fund Advisors. Timothy Levin, Stephen Hansen, and Jennifer Klass will discuss recent trends in the SEC examination process, as well as current and important regulatory and inspection priorities for private fund advisors in the hedge fund industry. Now, on to the podcast.
Good morning, and thanks for joining us this morning. This is the Regulatory and Examination Priorities for Private Fund Advisors panel. I'm Tim Levin. I'm mostly moderating this morning. Joined today by two of my partners who focus on SEC examination and enforcement matters for advisors and private funds, Steve Hansen and Jennifer Klass. Our first topic here is to focus a little bit on some of the examination developments and specifically on some of the resources that the SEC is now bringing to bear in their examination program. Jen, why don't you kick that off?
Great. Thanks, Tim. Good morning, everyone. So this has been a consistent theme that we've been talking about at this conference for a number of years, and we continue to see the SEC focus not just on the examination program in general as it relates to asset management, but really on continuing to add resources with respect to the investment advisor component of that. In the last year, they've added 100 new investment advisor examiners. That was after adding 70 in 2015. So they're up to about 630 examiners, which is a 35% increase. So they really are continuing to expand the number of examiners that are focused on the investment advisor space, and particularly with respect to private fund advisors. They're also increasing their resources by shifting examiners who were previously dedicated to broker-dealer inspections to the investment advisor side. And in part, that reflects the fact that a FINRA exists on the broker-dealer side, and it also reflects the increased growth in the number of investment advisors versus broker-dealers. And finally, from a resource perspective and a concentration perspective, the private fund unit was announced in 2014, and that is an internal unit within OC that's focused on private fund advisors, hedge funds, private equity, real estate, and they continue to expand the number of sort of asset classes and types of private fund advisors that they're focused on. And that unit continues to be very active, both in terms of providing resources for the traditional investment advisor examiners and also conducting and initiating exams themselves. It's also interesting to note that one of the initial co-founders or heads of that group was Mark Wyatt. He's no longer the head of that group, but he's now moved on and is the head of OC. So the head of OC right now has a significant amount of experience in the private fund space.
I think we might add that the members of the private fund unit, many of them have experience in the private fund space. So I haven't had the question raised, what is carry, in a long time, right? That there are people who actually have worked in the industry and know the language, may not always view things the way we do. In fact, there's a fair amount of occasions when they don't. But there is a greater expertise than we saw historically. Shall we move on to analytics?
Yes.
Okay, good. Well, you heard in the opening panel in our kickoff group about the importance of the analytics from the SEC staff perspective. In the examination space, these analytics are being used to identify firms to be examined. We don't have a lot of visibility, or at least I don't, into what those metrics really are, but that's talked about a lot. More visible to us from the examination process is what happens during the examination itself. And anyone who's been examined knows this, and those of you who are awaiting a more recent examination will quickly learn that a large amount of trade data will be requested as an absolute standard matter in an examination. I cannot think maybe one examination in recent history out of scores that I've had visibility into has not asked for substantial trade data. And then that trade data is run through those big computers down in Washington and looking for probably the same things you would look for if you were on the other side, including trading ahead in personal accounts, questions that might arise with respect to favorable allocations, differential performance between parallel funds, and the like. The challenge, I think, for all of us is that the examiners who have these tools and have this data may be a step ahead of us. That is, our routine surveillance or our work and even preparation for an examination may not go into the same depth that this examination process now is going into. So that's something for us to keep an eye on and think about how, from our side of the examination items, we think about that. Now, it was insisted that we call this the examination panel. I wanted to call it pre-enforcement, but I was told that was too cynical. It certainly is the case that a lot of examinations these days have an enforcement edge to them. We still see maybe 10%, give or take, the numbers are tough to really follow, actually go over into enforcement. But the threat is there, and the fact that there now are so many interviews as part of the standard examination process to follow up on, gee, why are there lumpy trades, or why does this fund perform better, that the facts get established earlier and earlier in the timeline. And by the time you get to meet enforcement, a lot of these things have already been drilled down into fairly deeply.
I think, Steve, one observation I've had arising out of those factors is that it's also become a lot more expensive and a lot more of an internal drain on resources to deal with a, you know, what seems like it is a routine examination, but nonetheless involves a fairly substantial commitment of resources from the
government. We're seeing many more firms treat examinations the way you would treat an investigation historically and do preparation and try to think through where things are headed. Now, often you have some idea if there's a weak spot and you know to put particular resources in thinking that through. But even in the more general, diffuse examination, I think that's absolutely right, Tim.
So with that big picture background, Steve, if you could talk about one or two of the substantial focus areas that we're seeing in the examination.
Well, not surprisingly, when we've sat down to write, what is it that are substantive areas that might be focuses of examination and the like, it sounded a lot like the enforcement panel that preceded us. So we'll keep parts of this a little bit brief, but the correlation there, I think, is part of the message. Big, big, big in the private fund space over the last 12 to 18 months has been the focus on fees and expenses. You heard about that from the prior panel on unhappy endings there. It is, I think, essentially assured that a full examination will look at your fee structure, will look at revenue flows, and then compare that to the agreements, compare it to the disclosures. And of course, the big point is disclosure alone may not suffice if there's not otherwise an arrangement or an agreement that a particular fee is payable. The staff position in the examination context, I think parallel to the position in the enforcement context, is if there's an ambiguity about your ability to charge a fee, you don't get to do it. At least that's the staff view. So we've seen that a lot, particularly with respect to private equity, though the lines there are blurring because so many hedge managers now will have a finger in private equity. What the senior staff in the private fund unit has been saying recently is that they're going to be segueing from focusing on private equity fees and expenses to looking for analogous problems over on the hedge side, particularly with accounts that might have a heavy insider component, that is, where either management or friends of management have a perhaps disproportionate part of a fund, or maybe even essentially a prop fund, looking for the same kind of lack of consistency, if you will, in the treatment of fees and expenses. So at least that's some of the headline areas that we're expecting, Tim, to continue to be front burner.
And Jen, I guess the mirror image of proprietary and near proprietary accounts are the issues that arise in connection with side-by-side management.
Exactly. I mean, and this has long been a focus. It continues to be a significant focus because of the conflicts of interest that come to play here. But the SEC is very focused on the allocation of investment opportunities among client accounts and non-client accounts. And really, it comes down to what are the factors that the firm takes into consideration in making a determination where to allocate the investment opportunities. Are those factors clearly disclosed? Are they objective or are they subjective? If they're subjective, is there some testing after the fact, at least, to ensure that there's no preferential treatment, particularly as it relates to co-investment vehicles? The next component that the staff focuses on is to what degree are those considerations disclosed and disclosed clearly to clients, both in form ADVs, really in form ADVs, and to some degree in PPMs. And then, ultimately, how cognizant is the firm of the conflicts that arise?
Steve, why do you think the staff's focus on affiliated service providers?
We've seen that particularly in real estate-related funds and the like, because essentially it's a related party transaction issue. And so the question is, if you're using a related party to provide some services to the fund, to clients, ultimately, what's the check on fairness of that? Is it consistent, starting with the various disclosure documents? And often we'll see disclosure documents, which we'll talk about concepts of fairness. Well, how do you check that the pricing is in fact fair? So these are all echoes, I think, of the same kind of idea, which is, are managers in some way advantaging themselves at the expense of the underlying investors?
Yeah. Well, and also the staff talks very often in the examination enforcement context about the importance of gatekeepers and how various service providers in the industry sort of function as gatekeepers, and affiliated service providers are sort of, in some sense, an absence of a gatekeeper as you're thinking about some of these conflicts. And then exempt reporting advisors and the SEC's focus there.
I'm still scratching my head over exempt reporting advisors, but the staff has said that they're going to be looking at exempt reporting advisors. And in fact, we've even seen some instances of that. I wasn't surprised that they said it, because if you're the staff, you want to say you're going to be everywhere. You're not going to leave some ground untended. I was a little more surprised to see it in practice. And where I've seen it, at least I think where we've seen it collectively, has been fairly focused exams, kind of quick in and out, looking to trace funds to make sure funds have not been misapplied, and then also looking at trading type conflicts. Those are the areas, at least, that we've seen so far, in fact, on the ground with exempt reporting advisors.
And these are advisors, just to be clear, who are relying on the private fund advisor exception or the venture capital fund exemption, and so are not registered full-on with the SEC, but have filed as an exempt reporting advisor. On the compliance side, just a note that the staff continues to focus on the effectiveness of the control functions within firms around things like compliance and risk functions. They are focused on the culture and the resource dedication to compliance, as well as the formalization of the controls, and focus on, again, conflicts of interest. Some of the more recent enforcement cases have focused on firms that have multiple compliance failures or systemic compliance failures. And so one of the things that we try to emphasize for firms is to make sure that the control functions are not siloed and that there really is sort of an integrated control structure that's working together. And then lastly, there was a lot of discussion of marketing and advertising on the prior panel. It's an area that always very interesting to the staff, both in terms of enforcement actions and also examinations, in part because the staff use it as the critical sales function. It's the first place that the firm is making representations to potential investors, whether through fundraising or otherwise, or to existing clients and investors to have them invest more assets. More recently, we're seeing the staff very focused on the representations that are being made through marketing materials, whether that's performance-related or just more generally representations as to the experience and the investment objectives and philosophy of the firm. There's also a lot of focus on performance attribution as it relates to spin-outs or portfolio management teams that might have come from one firm and moved to another, portability.
Our list of examination focus areas continues. Steve, why don't you talk a little bit about
it could have been endless, Tim, but we did make it a finite number, so there's hope for those of you that wonder if there are 27,000 top priorities. We did want to flag the whistleblowing concept. You heard a little bit about it in the opening panel from the enforcement action side. What we're seeing in examinations is it's very, very, very common, close to standard, to be asked whether to show the staff your confidentiality policies, your form of letters that you might use with folks who are departing, any kind of place where there could be a confidentiality type arrangement, contractual or in policies. And then the implied question is, well, is there a carve out? Have you explained to people that this doesn't preclude them from going to the SEC and whistleblowing? And word has been out on this for some time. There was a sweep examination now over a year ago, but we're still seeing the exam staff looking at this, and frankly, we're still seeing a fair number of fund managers that haven't brought those policies quite up to the place where we think the SEC expects them to be. So that's sort of a, gee, go back and let's make sure we're comfortable with it kind of item. Nothing super profound there. A little bit of awkwardness to put into these kinds of communications. The fact that, by the way, you can go whistleblow if you want to, but you can express that in a number of ways as long as it's clear. So we move right on to material non-public information. Keep on a roll?
Yeah,
okay.
Keep going.
Well, the big news in the material non-public information insider trading world, you heard some about and you've undoubtedly seen in the press, has to do with interpretations of what is and isn't insider trading, the Newman case, the case then Salmon that's going up to the Supreme Court. On the other end, we're seeing the effect of those challenges to the theory of particularly Tip E liability playing out in the examinations in an interesting way. And I'd say it's through a renewed emphasis and focus on policies and procedures with respect to controlling potential material non-public information. Essentially, the drill is this. The exam staff ask, where are all the places where you might touch material non-public information? Not that you are, but just that you might. So, basic case, do your research analysts go meet with management of issuers? Well, how do you know that they're not getting material non-public information and that's working its way into your trading? Do you log when you have these meetings? Do you follow up to find out what the meetings were about? Are you doing some checking on those processes? Things as basic as that now are being emphasized in the examination process, and particularly if you have something, some unusual touches. So maybe you have some large investors in your fund who are members of senior management of issuers. You trade that name. You can be guaranteed that you'll be asked about what policies and procedures you've wrapped around that. And of course, then on the enforcement side, there can be actual enforcement proceedings which are based solely on deficiencies in policies and procedures, don't require an underlying violation. So we're very sensitive in the examination context to making sure that folks are able to articulate the robust policies they have around controlling material non-public information. There was a recent enforcement proceeding came down last week that raises kind of an interesting twist on this. Some of us use various forms of consultants in our business that are sometimes closer, sometimes farther away from the kind of core activities. In the instance involving the shop last week, the finding at least was that the consultant was very close to investment decision making and had high visibility into fund investment decision making and holdings, and contention of the staff, and then the settlement that resulted, was that the consultant should have been treated as the equivalent of an access person for purposes of all of the code of ethics rules and the like. And we've seen that on the examination side. It's sort of a sliding scale. How close are these things? But I think this issue will be one that continues to be an examination issue.
Yeah. And Jen, what about custody? We've been living with the new custody rule for a number of years now, and it seems that on the examination side, but also just on the client implementation side, it continues to raise very vexing issues.
It does, even though it's not new anymore. You know, in the past, we've seen the staff focus on custody sort of at the technical level. That is, does the firm realize it has custody? Are you complying with the private fund exceptions from the custody rule? Are you delivering audited financials within 120 days? Those kinds of things. Currently, what we're seeing is the staff go much deeper in terms of custody and really look at special purpose vehicles, evaluating whether there are layers of different vehicles, blockers, et cetera, whether each of the different vehicles is in fact a client of the advisor that needs to be treated as complying with the custody rule. We're seeing a lot of questions come up in the private equity and real estate context about whether the funds themselves are clients and whether the assets they're holding, in fact, are securities that need to be subject to the custody rule. So if you're talking about real estate, you know, are we talking about dirt or are we talking about the limited partnerships and vehicles above it that hold the interest in the real estate? In the private equity space, it's not uncommon to see things like diamonds and ships and talk about real assets and think about how those things interface with the custody rule. So it sort of becomes custody 2.0 in terms of the level of sophistication, but the issues are just as vexing.
Well, and if we're talking about diamonds, can barrels of whiskey be far behind?
Right.
Exactly. Yeah, so yeah, it can get complicated as you work down the chain there. Yeah. I think we're going to talk for 30 seconds about valuation.
Let's do that.
Yeah, so we're talking about valuation. My perception here, and as I talk to my colleagues who work with managers going through examinations, that the valuation issues, of course, are most acute for those who have difficult to value assets. A lot of folks, it's pretty straightforward and familiar and hasn't raised much of a problem. What we see with more difficult to value assets, illiquids of various sorts and the like, is heavy, heavy, heavy emphasis on process, and with essentially the examination being an audit of your process, either Do you have a process or are you following your process? And where we've had issues arise is where it looked like this year's write-ups looked like last year's write-ups and didn't take into account potentially objective changes during the period of time or things of that type where it looks like the policy is maybe one that observed only in passing, not in reality. Where policies have been robust and been followed, we haven't seen particularly much second-guessing of the outcome. That is, you have a policy, it has rigor to it, and it yielded X. We haven't, or at least I've not seen and heard of, a situation where the staff took the position that X was the wrong number, it needed to be X plus one.
Right.
And Steve, in our last couple of minutes here, why don't we just take a few moments to focus on what we see as some of the coming attractions.
What are we going to talk about next year? We always want to plan ahead when we're doing a panel like this. And from your perspective as private fund managers, the specter of the FinCEN rule coming into effect, there's a rule proposal out there that may well move forward and become actually a rule so that those of us in the advisory world will be subject to some of the AML requirements that we have lived without so well. They're not surprising, and I think a lot of us have lived with self-imposed AML-lite type policies, but a couple of things that will be different. One is the SEC, if this rule goes forward, will be responsible for oversight that by arrangement. That means this will become an examination item for us in a fuller way than it has historically. And whenever something's new, it tends to be something that staff looks at more broadly and more deeply. Secondly, this will bring with it, if it comes as expected, the obligation to file suspicious activity reports. And there's a lot of trickiness around making the judgments, having a process to make those judgments. It starts out with the core idea of money laundering issues and anti-terrorist financing issues. But as those of you that have affiliates that operate in the broker-dealer world or elsewhere, maybe in the banking world, know the whole concept of when you have to file and are expected to file a SAR as a way of growing out. And so that whole process, I think, will be a challenge for us. There are also some strict confidentiality rules that will apply around it, which will need some support.
And Jen, what about the Investment Advisors Modernization Act? Are we scrapping the whole current statute?
Not the entire statute. Okay. There's a proposal, and the legislation hasn't actually been introduced yet. But it's an interesting proposal in that it would provide a lot of flexibility both for all advisors and for private equity advisors in certain instances around things like the custody rule and some of the trip-ups that we were talking about and things that vex the private equity advisors. Form ADV delivery would be made more flexible. You could, for example, satisfy Form ADV delivery obligations to a fund and by extension to the investors in the fund by relying on the private placement, the PPM, so long as they included the relevant information. There is a proposal in the legislation that would peel back the testimonial and pass specific recommendation rules of the advertising rule so long as the material is being provided solely to essentially accredited investors, QPs, qualified clients, et cetera. Essentially what the Modernization Act is trying to do is to bend the Advisors Act slightly to acknowledge the fact that so many advisors these days are in the private advisor space and that the rules that traditionally have applied to all asset managers need to be slightly nuanced with respect to that universe of advisors.
Thank you both.
Thank you.
To listen to other panels from the 2016 9th Annual Advanced Topics in Hedge Fund Practices Conference, visit our Hedge Fund University at morganlewis.com/hedgefunduniversity. If you have any questions or would like more information on the topics addressed in this podcast, please contact a Morgan Lewis attorney at morganlewis.com. This podcast is provided as a general informational service to clients and friends of Morgan Lewis & Bockius LLP. It should not be construed as and does not constitute legal advice on any specific matter, nor does this message create an attorney-client relationship. These materials may be considered attorney advertising in some states. Please note that any prior results discussed in the material do not guarantee similar outcomes. Read more about Morgan Lewis and its hedge funds practice at morganlewis.com/hedgefunduniversity.